The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 135, and today is July 4th, 2008. So, if you're not familiar, if you're an international listener and somehow or another you're not familiar with July 4th, this is America's Independence Day. So, good news for me is I get it off from work, which unfortunately I think has become the sort of national standard of why Independence Day is important, is we get a day off. But no, it's a good day, and it's something that we should celebrate. It's sort of our national holiday and all that. There'll be fireworks and everybody's having barbecues and all of that, and it's great when it falls on a Friday because you get a three-day weekend. So in any case, we have a really, really big show today. We've got a long call with Jules. We're wrapping up the Assen race. A lot of insight that we had. We stayed on the phone for about an hour and a half, and I listened to it, and it's just really good stuff, I thought. Very, very interesting, and I think that you will like it too. We're going to address some Casey Stoner comments. We got a whole ton of email this past week about Stoner bashing, and we're going to address that because neither Jules nor I think that we're big Stoner bashers, so we're going to talk about that a little bit. And we'll see if the email kind of slows off to a trickle or not, or whatever. Other than that, got a couple of news items. I'm going to talk a little bit of my track day here at the end of the show and some other stuff going on. It's a long one, but I think you'll like it, and it's perfect for the holiday weekend for those of us here in the United States. And if you're an international listener, it's like, well, you know, you can fit it into one more commute or something like that. It's going to be a long show today. Before we get into the whole show, I do want to give a big old shout out thank you to Wayne Harrison, who is very, very kind enough to send me a Donington MotoGP t-shirt from Donington, oddly enough. Because he was there, he went, Wayne Harrison, one of our UK listeners, and he bought me a t-shirt. And I gotta say, judging from my experience when I went to Donington in 2004, and the t-shirts that I bought there, this was awesome. This was the perfect MotoGP weekend t-shirt that I was looking for. You know, it's garish, lots of colors on the back. It's got, you know, all the rounds for the whole year, you know, so it's a bit like a concert t-shirt where you have the different dates and all of that sort of thing. This is awesome stuff. And we go to Laguna Seca, and yeah, you know, they have t-shirts, and they're not bad, but they don't hold a candle to the British ones. So thank you very much, Wayne, for that. I do appreciate that. And a further shout-out thank you to James Pickens, Corey Solovey, and David Young. All these guys were kind enough to donate to MotoGPOD. David Young made a considerable donation. I do appreciate that. And I'm actually – what we're doing with some of that donation money is Jules and I are for sure going to Indy. So we had to start worrying about buying tickets and all of that sort of thing. So the money's helping to pay for that. And, of course, the money always helps pay for the hosting and the Skype bill and all the other expenses that come along with running a podcast, along with, as you all know, the beer tab, which can occasionally start running up. So let's see. I do appreciate that. Thank you very, very much, guys. But that should cover our shout-outs on that score. Let's see. One thing I wanted to talk about before we get into Jules is the call with Jules that we did, because this is a little bit of news, and it's kind of interesting. MotoGP secures CBS and NBC broadcasts over the summer. Now, this is good news for those of you international listeners. CBS and NBC are over the air. Television broadcast. Everybody gets this stuff. It's not on cable like it normally is on Speed Channel. I had noticed that the Laguna Seca race and a couple of the other races were, you know, mysteriously missing from the Speed Vision, or excuse me, Speed Channel, Speed Vision. Wow, that's old. But from the Speed Channel schedule. And so I figured that they were going to be showing up on one of the other channels, where there's Fox that actually owns Speed Channel or CBS or NBC, somebody somewhere. But unfortunately, their schedules did not go far enough out. The last time I looked was probably a couple of weeks ago. But we had a press release here last week from Dorna, and they're telling us that MotoGP will be broadcast on network television across the United States once again this summer after an agreement was reached between MotoGP's commercial rights holder Dorna Sports and both CBS and NBC. So we're going to see three races broadcast on the CBS television network, including live coverage of the 2008 Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix at Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca. And additionally on CBS Sports, there's an hour-long same-day delay broadcast from the Elite Motorrad Grand Prix Deutschland at the Sachsenring on July 13th. At 1 p.m., which most likely is going to be adjusted for your local times. But the press release just says 1 p.m. So if you're in the – that's probably Eastern. If you're Pacific, make sure you double-check that it may be on at 11 o'clock for you. It may be held over for 1 p.m. And, of course, Mountain and Central adjust accordingly. And also, Brno is going to be on CBS. So, and then NBC is going to do live coverage of the inaugural Red Bull Indianapolis Grand Prix from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on September 14th at 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, ensuring a momentous occasion for the sport will be televised to the wider public. And this all fits in, and Jules and I talked about this a little bit in our call, with Dorna's quest to get MotoGP on over-the-air television, television that everybody can get. You don't have to be buying cable or satellite or what have you, paying for a premium channel that, you know, you can just turn on your local over-the-air television and see MotoGP. So I think that's one reason that Dorna is really on board with that. The question that I have, and unfortunately I could not find any answers to this, is who are the commentators going to be? The press release does tell us that we're going to have the expert analysis from an experienced commentary team and news and interviews with the top writers in the series. However, they don't say who that's going to be. Now, if you recall last year, and if you've been listening for a while, I did some comparisons of the commentary that we had from CBS last year versus the commentary from the Dorna feed versus the commentary from the Eurosport guys, all that sort of thing, taking the same little chunk of the race, like one specific corner or whatever, and contrasting the different styles of commentary, and I have to say the U.S. commentary came up rather short. So I'm hoping that this year that they'll get their act together and it'll be a little bit better because commentary is important. You know, true MotoGP fans like you and I should probably just watch this stuff without commentary and we would be happy because, you know, we could follow along and all that sort of thing. If you're not a major MotoGP fan, if you're just a casual fan or maybe somebody entirely new to the sport or something like that, you really need the commentary. And even for me, I think the commentary makes the race more enjoyable. So I depend on good commentary, and I really hope that CBS and NBC come through. And who knows, maybe we'll have to have another Pepsi challenge of commentaries. We'll have to see. So that's our little news tidbit for the day. The rest of the stuff that happened during the week, Jules and I kind of covered during our call. So why don't we go ahead and get right into that, and let's get started. All right, we got Jules on the phone today. How you doing again, Jules?
I'm doing fine. My fingers are bleeding.
Fingers are bleeding from the emails that we've had this week.
That's right.
Yes. My brain is bleeding, actually. I was looking at the numbers today. Besides our sort of internal, me and you and Darren chit-chat and other stuff, it got a little out of control. So I hope I managed to answer everybody's emails. I'd like to at least acknowledge and say, you know, hey, thanks for sending me an email, even if I don't have time to send out a well-thought-out and erudite reply. I like to at least sort of say, you know, thanks for the email, because I do appreciate the email, and I know you do too, Jules.
I love the conversations that we have.
Yeah, yeah. It's great, because, you know, I mean, we get to hear from the people that we're talking to, the fans, and, you know, basically our friends out there on the internet talking about the sport that we love.
I should mention that when people I think most listeners don't realize that when they send in the form from the website, that also goes to me.
Oh yeah, maybe they
so
don't
they,
know.
They may get, maybe they get surprised when like they say, "Hey Bob, what do you think about this?" And then they get a reply from me. So that's why,
right?
Because Bob set that up a couple of months ago, I think.
Right, it's been a little while, and it's basically you know, and I appreciate it, Jules. It's kind of to help offset some of the load, frankly. You know, answering the emails and stuff. And if I go out of town, like I had a track day this past weekend, I was away from my email for a couple of days. I just didn't bother. And, you know, so you were handling it.
And so I really enjoy it. So keep sending that stuff in.
Yeah, go ahead and keep on. Like Jules said, you can go to MotoGPOD.com and fill out the little web form that automatically goes to both of us, or you can send it to either of us. The addresses are all out there. They're all public. And we really do like to hear from you. We're still getting stuff from Donington. I'm sure you are too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's just, it's fantastic. We're getting a lot of, like, you know, eyewitness reports, and it's interesting to hear some of the take from a guy that's on one side of the circuit versus the guy that's on the other side of the circuit.
Did you notice that stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, in any case, let's move on. What should we start with? We're going to jump right into Assen?
All right. You know, we'll do our usual. I really like that format you guys, you and Darren started, where you just go down the line.
Yeah, I think it works well.
We talk about the writer. Yeah. If I didn't say anything interesting about that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, finishing order of the race. The first guy we're going to talk about is that young Australian fella. What is his name? It escapes me. I have no idea.
Casey Stoner.
That's Casey Stoner. Yes, the guy with a hot wife and an extremely talented writer. So I'm told.
Yeah. So apparently, a lot of people think that we don't think that he's a talented writer.
Yes. And that's it's a little bit Laurel and Hardy-ish of me here, and feeding Jules, my straight man, some stuff here. But we got a lot of email that we're big old stoner bashers, and both Jules and I are a little bit like, wait, you know, well, let's hold on. So, I mean, why don't you go ahead? I think you had more responses, Jules, and actually you had more reasonably worded responses to some of this whole thing. So do you want to sort of explain? Because I think you and I agree on what we're talking about here.
Yeah. I think listeners need to understand that the podcast is not just a, even when you were doing it alone, and certainly when we're doing it together, it's not like this is the way Bob or Jules think things are, and God damn it, that's the way it is. You know, we're trying to, express our own opinions, but also take into account the opinions of the other fans and of how the sport works and how, you know, the entire show works, because it is, you know, entertainment. All sports are eventually become entertainment unless you're the ones participating in it. And even then, it could be very entertaining.
I was just going to say, yeah, it could be extremely entertaining to be participating in it.
I certainly wouldn't mind being entertaining other people while riding a MotoGP bike.
Yeah.
But so I think that a lot of the frustration from last time, we spent a lot of time talking about Casey Stoner and the supposed lack of respect that he gets, I think it came off the wrong way, and I just wanted to make sure that people understand that we're talking about a rider who has completely dominated last season, and he is, when he's on form, he's an incredible rider, and he's a phenomenon, I think everybody respects him for his riding, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be revered the same way that some of these other guys are who have been around longer. I mean, Casey's only been around in MotoGP for 3 years. This is the third year.
Right.
His first year was kind of some astonishing moments, but also he had a reputation for being a crasher. Didn't really, except for the first few races, like he just kept falling further and further behind in the championship because of his non-finishes. And then last year he just popped out of almost nowhere. It was, you know, I should probably say, like, trademarked perfect storm.
Going to get some heat about that one. Cause
what's that?
We're going to get some heat about that one, but I still stand behind my comments. It was a perfect storm. 15 good bike, good rider.
I think also that he is the only rider out there who has completely managed to change the way he needed to ride that bike. That bike is, I think, the best bike on the grid. Maybe the Yamahas are better this year because they're more rideable. But in the right hands, I think the Ducati is the best bike out there. But the only one who's really been able to figure it out is Stoner, because he has been able to unlearn a lot of things that riders have been learning since they first got on the motorcycle.
Right.
And I actually had a great conversation with David Emmett from the Kropotkin Thinks blog, who was at the race. And he said that he noticed something very interesting, which was that the first right-hander at the end of the front straight, he was watching very carefully and noticed that Stoner was braking about 5 meters. 5 meters, that's a long time, later than the rest of the crew, mm-hmm. and then getting on the gas much earlier. So he was doing the old 990-style squaring off the corner kind of riding. And we've been talking about the 800s being ridden in a much more 250 type of way, where you try to keep corner speed up, and it sounds like he's actually figured out a way to just nail the throttle out of the corner, be able to brake later, which means he's braking harder, which means he's got to do a tighter turn, and then getting on the gas completely trusting the electronics. That does, and when I say this, I'm not taking credit away from skill, because that is a skill to be able to do that and not have your body freak out when the, I mean, you, even when he was doing a wheelie across the finish line, did you notice how much that bike was shaking around?
Actually, I didn't, but
yeah, I mean, he's that bike is always wobbling. It's a very unnerving feeling, especially when you're coming out of a corner, because you have to basically unlearn a lot of, you know, flight and fight type of physiology that's built into the human body, and especially these riders have been on non-electronically, you know, not fly-by-wire motorcycles for so long. So anyway, so David goes on and says that he was braking later, much later than the rest of the riders, and the sound of his motorcycle is very different than the sound of Melandri, Gentoli, or Elias when they go through like really slow corners, like the hairpin in Assen.
Uh-huh.
And that's not because the bike is different; it's because of how they're using the throttle. So again. Right. It shows that he has figured something out that the other guys have still not figured out. It may be even information that they have shared with. I mean, I'm sure that the team wants good results from all the riders. We know this because they're really down on Melandri,
right?
And you know, Elias went to Bologna and talked to the technician. So they're trying to get this whole thing across.
Yeah, I'd be very, very surprised if Stoner is not sharing a lot of information with at least. With Melandri and probably with the Dantin team as well.
Yeah, I mean, his information goes back to the engineers. That goes back to the factory. The factory then wants all the bikes on the, you know, doing well, so they're gonna pass that back down to the riders, even if it's not like specifics. I think that he has obviously mastered the machine and he's fantastic, but. You could say all this stuff, and if you're a purist, and you just want to see a guy riding around the track as fast as possible, yes, he is incredible. But this whole like Stoner bash—we're Stoner bashing because we don't give him the same kind of reverence or something that we might give to somebody like Valentino Rossi or even Colin Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more to, you know, being a fan of someone than just seeing results, because I might as well not watch races. I might just look at timesheets too, right? I mean,
right. It's not, so it's much not more baseball where you can just look at a sheet of statistics and get this great satisfaction.
And some nice photos or footage. I mean, you know, TT racers don't ride, wheel to wheel because they're staggered and there's a certain kind of fan that likes that kind of racing, and there's a certain kind of fan that likes close in racing, and when Stoner runs off with these races, it is kind of a shame. And there's a lot of people that are commenting, well, when Rossi was dominating and would win by, you know, 10 seconds 11 seconds, people don't have the same kind of response, and it is because there's another part to Rossi, and actually he's had very few races where he's had that kind of domination.
But that's
not the point. The point is that the guy is such a charismatic, interesting person. Even on the track, when you're watching him on the track, he's an entertaining person to watch. And, you know, I'm sorry, but that's just something that's the only reason why this keeps coming up is because it's Stoner who's making all the noise. I want respect. This started last year, like halfway through the season, when everybody was saying that it's the Ducati and not him. And it was obvious that it was not just the Ducati, because if Caparossi was the litmus test. And
we're already going a little longer with this than we wanted to, because you and I discussed what we wanted to say. And both you and I agree, and we've talked a lot. And we send a lot of emails back and forth to listeners and all sorts of stuff that, yes, Stoner is, I think, he's a freaking awesome writer. He really is. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jules, that the whole thing is a show. and that if you're going to treat MotoGP as a show and you're going to call it the MotoGP circus and all of that, which it is, then there is more to it. And granted, you can be the grumpy guy that doesn't give the interviews or what have you. And I'm not saying Stoner is this, so I don't want a bunch of emails about how Stoner, you know, but you know, like doing. And you can do that, but it's still, you're going to get a different fan base than if you're the guy that the Valentino Rossi or the Nicky Hayden or the Colin Edwards or the
Lorenzo.
Yes. Know. And we've talked about that.
You know, we've talked with Toslin.
The piano. Yes. That's what Stoner should do. He should show off his piano playing skills. You know, his sister made a CD in Australia, like a country music CD. And she's sort of becoming her own musical star in Australia.
That's just another minus against Stoner, dude. Come on.
No, it's not. It's just his sister who's, you know, I'm sure she's a wonderful singer. It was a little bit like, you know, the family says, hey, sis, you know, you're 21. We're moving to Europe and taking Casey to go be a motorcycle racer. You're on your own, bitch. But
nice. Well said.
But no, she's successful in her own right, and that's really cool. So I mean, this family, they're driven. They're successful at their chosen professions and all of that. And we believe, you know, all of you listeners out there, believe me, believe Jules. We think Stoner is freaking miraculous, but I still stand behind the saying that he's just not quite the same charismatic showman that Valentino Rossi is. And
he never will be. One should not expect him to be forced to be that way. There was a great comment by one of the people that emailed us, and I'm sorry I don't remember your name, but that's because there's been so many people that they've all kind of like merged at this point. John, Richard, Kelly, Bob, whatever your name is. He made a great comment, which was that Australians pride themselves on this quiet achievement.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. But the problem is that Stoner has not been exactly a quiet.
And right, right.
When he complains to the British fans that, what do I have to do to get your respect, that starts a backlash. And
exactly.
You know, and he's not helping matters by saying that. You know, people always say, well, Danny Pedrosa is even more of a robot than Stoner, of course, whatever. But he doesn't go out there and say, I want some respect. You know, he just does it on the track, and that's it. That's quiet achievement right there. Pedrosa is quiet achievement. He just...
I think you're going to get a bunch more email. But let's cut it off. Let's leave it at that. We got to move on with the show.
I'm sorry.
Trust us out there. We like Casey Stoner too. We really do. It's just that, hey, for one, okay, like Jules said earlier on, this, we do try to kind of cover everything and be at least reasonably balanced in this show. And two, let's face facts. This is an amateur podcast run by a couple of fans. And in effect, it becomes a sort of a fanboy show. And it's no secret that I'm kind of a big Nicky Hayden fan. And I will cut him some slack where others may not. Simply because, you know, I'm a fan, right? It's not meaning I love the guy. I certainly don't want any damn naked pictures of him. But, if I was a huge Casey Stoner fan, this show would be a little different. And it's not that I'm not a Casey Stoner fan. It's just that, hey, I'm sorry. If it was like, let's see Casey Stoner and Nicky Hayden racing wheel to wheel, I want Nicky to win. And I'm not going to make a secret of that.
Well said.
Thank you. All right, let's move down the grid, shall we?
So Stoner completely dominated the race.
He
didn't actually get the whole shot. Danny Pedrosa did get the whole shot, but Rossi did manage to pass him and then just took off. He finished the race 11 seconds ahead, but he probably would have been like 13 if he didn't, you know, slow down on the last lap.
I think he did some management there going on. I was a little surprised with the big old wheelie because what was his final gap? Oh,
it
was
hideous.
So yeah, maybe I'm thinking of Donington. Yeah. Yeah, that was huge. That's a big, big gap.
Yeah.
So you can do a giant wheelie across there because chances are, even if you throw the bike down the grid, you can pick it up and walk it across before Danny Pedrosa catches up.
Yeah.
Well, probably not in 10 seconds, but you know what I mean. So, all right. Yeah, he did. He dominated that race. He dominated qualifying and practice and everything else. It was a satisfying, good performance, you know, whatever to watch. It was because what was on Friday, the practice day, he goes out there and he breaks the track record by, do you recall how much it was?
0.8 seconds. And I think he did it like in the third lap. And this is one of the skills he has is not just on the track. He is the intimidator. Like, I mean, he'll go out there, he'll do five or six laps, break all sorts of records, get back into the garage and just sit there and watch the times go down. Yeah. Oh, it's time for me to go out again. Somebody's getting close, and then brutalize them again.
Yeah, you know? I notice he does do that, and that's that can't be winning him a whole lot of friends in the paddock.
Well, I think it's making people just scared, which means they get more stressed out. They ride worse, and you know whatever.
It's good racecraft. I think it's an excellent plan. And but all right, moving on. Second position. And I hope that we've given, you know, Casey Stoner suitable coverage and that everybody's happy. But moving on, Danny Pedrosa, second spot.
Another great race for Danny. And I was very interested to see, I only just noticed this just before as I was going through my notes that he was, Stoner had the fastest time during qualifying through a speed trap. Sorry, I'm talking about maximum speed. Pedrosa was up there, only about 3 kilometers off of Stoner's pace, and Stoner said that during qualifying. So I think, like, race pace wise, Danny Pedrosa's spring valve motor was one of the fastest bikes out there.
Right, you're talking absolute top speed.
Top speed.
Yeah.
Which is important at Aston because it's got a lot of though it doesn't have like what you'd call a, you know, it doesn't have like a Mugello style straight. It has a lot of very, very fast sections.
Yes, it does indeed. It's a high speed circuit, and I'm looking down the qualifying thing. Tony Elias had a 294, and this is kilometers. Pedrosa was 293.3, so Elias was a little faster. But I mean, hey, Elias qualified at 14th. Pedrosa qualified at second.
Exactly. And the other thing is that Pedrosa actually set a faster time on race tires. I mean, faster speed, sorry, again, speed, on race tires during free practice. He had 294.2 kilometers per hour. So, you know, that's amazing. And so basically it's Ducatis and Hondas because Nicky's air valve motor also was up there maximum speed-wise. I just wanted to note this because I think it's very, very interesting because there have been so much ruminations about this air valve motor from Honda, and like the spring valve is doing just well, just fine.
Yeah,
and
exactly. For some people,
Pedrosa's a championship.
When we get to Nicky Hayden, I've got a few comments about that, so don't let me forget.
Well, of course, on this race.
You know, Pedrosa did do a fantastic job, and it was kind of interesting to watch. And this is not denigrating either rider, but this, you know, the basically a battle between our two guys that kind of like to be out there on their own.
Yes,
you know that aren't the wheel to wheel battlers that Rossi and Toseland and some of these other guys are, and so it was really fun to watch them doing this together. And did you notice, remember this was a few months ago, there was a story that came out that said Pedrosa has some phobia, which I can't recall the exact name of the phobia, but is a fear of things to his right. You remember that?
No.
You never heard that one?
No, that's amazing.
Yeah, he suffers from, and I looked it up on Wikipedia, and it was documented on Wikipedia that there is this actual, you know, legitimate, it's anxiety disorder, not a phobia anymore. That, you know, that just simply having something to your right, you know, freaks you out. And that this was, you know, and there was a couple of stories that talking about whenever Pedrosa is on the podium and he's on, you know, when he's got somebody to his right, so he's what, in second spot, that, you know, he looks uneasy and all of that. And you know,
that's why he finishes third.
It didn't quite go into that, but it did sort of. You know, you're right. He always does look a little uncomfortable, and
that is really interesting.
When there was a pass, and it must have been Stoner.
There was a pass.
I'm sorry. Yeah, there was a pass. There was a couple of passes, but you know, Stoner stuffed it up under the right side of Pedrosa, And you saw Pedrosa had a moment. He just kind of went, well, you know, a little wobble, you know, nothing major, nothing that's going to create, you know, major, but enough for Pedrosa or for Stoner to be able to lock it in. And I was just wondering, it instantly made me think.
Wow, that is really interesting.
I'm sorry, I thought we talked about that.
No, that really plays into this whole Pedrosa likes to be on his own thing.
Sure, sure.
Because
if you do, I mean, if this is, and I mean, I'm not going to sit here and make fun of somebody's
phobia,
anxiety disorders, but you know, if it is something like that, where you know, for whatever, you know, anxiety disorders tend to be somewhat irrational fears, right? This is the nature of the beast, right?
Yes.
So you know, why would you be afraid of something simply because it's on your right when the same thing on your left doesn't bother you? You know, who knows? The brain is a funny thing, but if that's true, and
we're
Pedrosa
go
is battling
POD MD again,
exactly. I love it. if that's true, and Pedrosa is battling against this, then in some ways that you know, it means you got to kind of, you know, sort of respect the guy. But there was clearly, go back and watch the pass, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
I will definitely do that. That's very interesting. Uh-huh. Very interesting. Okay.
So in any case, Pedrosa, good race. Yay.
So before we go too further down, I wanted to mention that with this race, Casey Stoner now leads the championship in terms of laps led. Laps in first place. I looked this up earlier. He has now led 80 laps to Pedrosa's 60 and Rossi's 73.
Hmm. All right. I didn't know that. Thank you for that statistic. He has.
He's dominating again. Well, he's beginning his domination again.
Yeah. Well, he's got. This is his third race win, which, let's see, Pedrosa has three race wins.
Two.
Or, excuse me. But Rossi has three, and Pedrosa has two. So, yeah. So, I mean, yeah. He's doing well. He's catching up. He's closed that gap considerably. Like we talked about last time, all it takes is a little bit of misfortune on one guy's part. Good racecraft on another guy's part. Next thing you know, you've closed up that big gap.
Yep. Yep.
We're digressing. We're talking about Stoner again. Let's go back to Pedrosa, who also not only finishes the TT Assen in second spot, but becomes the championship leader at this point now with 171 points compared to Rossi's 167.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Very important.
Yes, it is indeed.
Especially because we're heading into Sachsenring, which is a track where Pedrosa has dominated in the past. I think Rossi can do well over there, but he's going to have his hands full with Danny, so it's going to be hard to claw. It's only 4 points, but it's going to be hard to claw them back.
Right.
But you know, when we get down to talking about Rossi, I mean, he really, that last point, passing Elias was extremely important.
Yes.
But we'll get there in a sec.
Yes, let's. Okay, so moving on. Third place, Colin Edwards.
This was unbelievable.
It was different. This was totally, totally different. And I don't know. What do you want to talk about first? How the third place came about?
Well, first of all, I think one of the most interesting things was that on the MotoGP feed, you know, it came out of nowhere. It just, like, we saw the, it looked like basically Hayden kind of let off the throttle because he was done.
Right.
You know, he was going to take that third place, but then, because you see it from the front and you see him going around the corner, but then you see him looking back and he's going really slow, and
there appeared to be some sort of come on bike, let's go sort of movement.
And then he did this like last ditch, you know, tuck in, no, you know, cut down on aerodynamic, I mean, just cut down on the parachute effect because he was sitting up. To just get that bike to roll across the finish line. But on the Eurosport feed, from the very beginning of the race, Neil Spaulding was talking about fuel management. So it was very prophetic because, of course, Honda has said that it was an electronic issue, but it
really
seemed. Yeah, but the thing is, you know, fuel is controlled by electronics, and Honda has a chat we had with Liam a long time ago about fuel management in these bikes and how Honda has it nailed. You know, maybe they had a slight glitch and it miscalculated because he literally ran. Well, we don't know if he ran out of fuel for sure, but it seemed like he ran out of fuel, and it was 50 meters from the finish line.
Yeah, hey, awful.
And what happened is, you know, Colin Edwards, who actually effectively was last because of the incident between Rossi and Depuñé, he ended up, you know, and he was on an amazing pace, and he ended up taking third on that last corner. And if listeners remember, in 2006, we had an incredible race, incredible last two laps of Assen between Hayden and Colin. Colin had put in, I think, one of the most astounding laps, final laps, because he was like over a second behind Hayden and managed to catch up. Went into the final chicane. Hayden completely overcooked it, went across the dirt. Colin actually managed to stay on the track, but fell into the inside of the final corner of the second part of the chicane and wiped out.
Right.
And, you know, I think I had a email conversation with one of the listeners about this a couple of shows ago, that, you know, when you go off track, you're supposed to give your place back to the guy that you passed by going off track.
Right, if you ever cut a chicane or something, right.
Yeah, exactly. So, but of course, you know, if the other guy crashes, then that's null and void. So I think that Colin really, has probably remembered that race. I mean, he came so close to winning his first MotoGP race. I'm sure he, you know, dreams about it often. And so he ended up, calling it the Karma Corner. He says he should be renamed the Karma Corner, which I think upset some people who made it sound like he was...
Gloating.
Gloating, exactly. But there was a conversation that Randy Mamola had with Nicky Hayden, where even though this was actually just moments after Nicky had gotten back to the garage, his voice was all shaking and, you know...
He did. He sounded upset. He almost sounded like he was going to cry. And not saying that in a bad way.
But I know. Because he was his first podium of the year, almost.
Right.
And he did actually mention kind of the same thing. He didn't say karma, but he did kind of say, like, well, you know, Colin and I had that thing, so I guess what goes around comes around.
Yeah, yeah. I watched that race. I watched the Assen race on Sunday. I watched the speed feed at Kelly's Olympic in Portland, which is a motorcycle bar. Where they have the races, and it was a very satisfying experience to be able to watch this race with some buddies in a bar and all of that. You know, it's been a long time since I've been able to do that. And I was up there with Darren Carpenter, who's been on the show, and Dave Sangster, who's an Omer regular and up there at the PIR, and Brad Hochhalter, who works for AMA, incidentally. And so we were all watching the race together, having a great time. And I recall that when they did the sort of after-race podium interviews and all this sort of stuff, and Colin said that, you know, what goes around comes around, I sent you a text. It's like, oh, my
That's
God.
Right. Yeah,
did you hear that? Because right. I was a little more shocked by it than I think you were. I think you put it somewhat into perspective and all of that yes, you know, there's a certain side of looking at things that the 2006 incident that possibly Colin should feel like he got a little bit screwed. But, you know, it was like, wow. I still kind of take it as a bit of a wow.
But, you know, I mean, this is Colin Edwards we're talking about. He's half – I mean, yeah, he does – feel like he does. I think he does feel like he deserved that win. And
sure, he probably does.
2006.
And I wouldn't put too much into it
more than anything else.
Being himself, and you can't put too much into this. It's not like he holds some bitter resentment up against Nicky, and one day he's going to show up to work with an AK-47 and all of this. No, it's just that, you know, this is he says things. He may say things occasionally off the cuff that seem a bit shocking. Because he just said stuff, you know.
I love the fact that when Randy Mamola interviews him, he almost always starts with "keep it clean."
Yeah, exactly. it's just
the guy basically just says what's on his mind is great.
Right. Exactly.
We love Colin Edwards.
He's not speaking the corporate line.
Yeah, you know,
the company line, and I so in any case, third place for Colin Edwards.
There was a lot of discussion.
Oh yeah,
about. Neil Spaulding kept coming on and on during the Eurosports thing, during the race, talking about the pneumatic engine and how Assen is known because of its length and speed to, you know, riders do run out of fuel on the cooldown lap very often. We remember that's very famous,
right?
When Rossi was celebrating one time and he had to get pushed back into the paddock and all that kind of stuff. So my guess is they misjudged it with Nikki.
Well, and I was talking about
the computer. Did I mean?
And I don't. You might not have been included in this email exchange, but I was talking about this with Anthony Dean over there at the Midwest Cafe Racers Association, and I sort of automatically assumed that they would have filled Nikki's fuel tank to the limit because we went to the 21-liter fuel tank. Was that last year? And
yep.
You know, there was. For this year. Yeah, right. We changed the rules so that this year the tanks are smaller. And there was some concern that it's like, you know, wow, that's one less liter of fuel. And frankly, I had assumed that Hayden would have been going out there with that tank topped off. I mean, when you're talking – when they had 22 liters, they were chilling the fuel to get it denser, to get in the fractional amounts.
I don't think it was an issue of how much they put in it. I think it was an issue of these maps that are constantly being modified to make sure that the bike makes it to the end. And it was, you know, software or sensor error or something like that that prevented the bike from, you know, switching to a more efficient map.
Yeah. On the hand, what was the gap? Let's see, for Hayden to Colin. You know, how far of a gap did he have going on? Do you have that sheet?
Before he ran
out of fuel.
I don't know. I don't know how I could get that information.
Because possibly, is there things that the rider can do to say, you know, screw that, I have to go.
4 seconds. He was 4 seconds ahead of Colin.
Which is actually a considerable gap.
Yeah. You think he did an override?
I don't know. Is it a possibility?
I don't think so. I really think that when they say electronic error, I mean, sensors, software, there's so much stuff going on with a fuel-injected motor. It could have been lots of things that caused the fuel, the bike to just consume a little more fuel than it was supposed to. I mean, we're talking about 21 liters for 26 laps.
Right, 118.43 kilometers, which works out to something like 73-odd miles.
Right.
And so the thing is that it doesn't take much to make a mistake.
Exactly. And these guys are playing with just get it to the finish line, figure out whatever. And somewhere during the race, maybe he had to use a little more. I still think Pedrosa, is programmed. His bike is, he's not programmed, but
yes, he is.
A lot of people might say that, but his bike is programmed to use much more fuel in the first, you know, two thirds of the race.
Do you think that the pneumatically valve engine revs about 1,000 revs higher, 1,000 RPM higher than the spring valve engine.
That's the claim, but you know, everybody's saying the same thing. It doesn't sound like it. Neil Spaulding said it, and actually David Emmett was made a point of saying that to me in an email, saying that he did not he could not tell the difference between the sound of the two motors at all.
Do you think the human ear is going to be what are you talking about? What 18.5 and 19.5? RPM? Or what off the top of our heads? Because I know I threw out a number last weekend or a couple weeks ago, and you corrected me. But in that range, 18 to 19. So you're looking at four cylinders, 19,000 RPMs. That's Steve Matchett always used to do the math on this. How many thousand, you know, controlled explosions a minute? You know, it's insane. It's a huge number. Can the human ear, unless you have perfect pitch, are you going to differentiate that at that point?
I think you can. I mean, certainly the Ducati sounds different than the Honda does. Of course, it's a different configuration in a lot of ways, and you got the Desmo,
right?
Versus, but you know,
it has that more thumpy, raw. It sounds like a V-twin. I know it's not a V-twin. It's a four-cylinder. But
some of the bikes are still, you know, between Big Bang and Screamers and all that kind of stuff. So, although I guess they're all Screamers this year.
Yeah, so that's what the rumor is. They do so much trickery with firing order and
the exhausts are different.
There's all sorts of stuff. I'm a little skeptical.
The only thing you can do is really is you put the same bikes together. That's the only like the two Repsol Hondas are the only ones that I would like. But I think that, you know, possibly they're still not actually letting it rev that high. Maybe they are limiting it.
Conserving it. Well, what I was getting at was that if it is revving a little bit higher, then it's going to be using more fuel. And possibly that, let's assume that Pedrosa and Hayden both go out with, you know, absolutely full tanks, as full as they can get. If Hayden's bike is consuming more fuel, it's going to go a shorter distance. That's just simple math, right?
Well, it is, but the thing is that revolutions per second doesn't necessarily mean that you're swallowing all that fuel, the same amount of fuel each time, because you can, I mean, that's what fuel injection is all about. You can be revving, you know, at 9,000 RPMs even on that kind of a bike, but if you start going uphill, you're pumping a little bit more fuel and then
right,
going downhill.
Right. So, and who's to say they have the same gearing as well, which is also going to make a big difference.
There's so many yeah. variables.
Yeah.
I think that he did run out of fuel, though.
I think so too. It looked like it. It. I mean, you could see Hayden willing that motorcycle to go.
Yeah.
And it just so yeah.
He
so,
did manage to roll it across.
Yeah, yeah.
And fourth.
He kept fourth, and it must have been a heartbreaker for him. You know, Colin Edwards. Let's face facts. Not denigrating Colin Edwards' talents as a writer, but he got lucky on that one.
Definitely lucky for that place, but you know, but he also got unlucky earlier in the race because
he did.
He had a decent start, but because of the he got entangled in that first third corner incident, he ended up really being in last place.
Right, exactly. Effectively,
until Rossi picked his bike up.
Yeah, exactly. Because on the end of lap one, you had Rossi and. West were the only people, you know, they were, 14th and 15th? No, 13th and 14th, excuse me, yeah. 13th and 14th, yeah. And Edwards was 12th. So yes, in effect, Edwards was dead last, and he moved up from that. So he did.
You can even look at it in the footage. Like if you look at what happens at the site of the crash between Rossi and De Punier, Edwards actually is forced to go around them on the outside on the rumble strip.
Right.
And then he rejoins the race. He's definitely last at that point. He must have already caught West by the end of the official lap.
Right. Right. Exactly. So he no screwing around. This guy made up a lot of positions through the whole race. He raced a good race. He was picking people off. And, you know, it's not like he didn't deserve this podium. You know, somebody has to be third. Somebody has to be fourth. Somebody has to be first. Otherwise, it's not racing. And so, moving on. Let's. I mean, we kind of covered Nicky Hayden's race. I think that we talked about the point that I wanted to make with the whole pneumatic engine. Although it does seem a bit like Pedrosa is still wringing more performance out of the spring valve engine than Hayden is out of the pneumatic engine. Is this because Pedrosa weighs? What we had a listener send us in all the weights, which are on MotoGP.com. It was great. It was nice to have it all in one spot where, you know, rather than having to collect the information, somebody nicely did it for us.
Well, it's you know, this whole rider weight thing has definitely been a since Pedrosa and a small bike were rolled out in 2007. I think that's been a big topic. He weighs 51 kilograms or 112 pounds versus Hayden, who
almost 150, 100 and.
Yeah. And considerably taller, too.
Right, exactly. He's big. He can't get a good tuck. I mean, the bike is tiny. The bike is built for Daniel Pedrosa. And I think Pedrosa packs his weight. There was a couple of years ago, you know, where he was just scooching in at over 100 pounds. And there was already rumors of that, you know, that they're sort of packing that weight figure.
Yeah.
Because it's not like boxing, you know, where it's super important.
Right. I think that a lot of there has been a lot of talk among fans of the sport that when you there's a very, 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 you know, specific weight that the bikes are allowed to have.
Right.
And I kind of like the idea of including the rider in that.
Like the 125s, you know? Do.
Yep.
I agree. Exactly. And like Formula One does as well. I actually agree.
Formula One does that?
Formula One does that, yeah.
I didn't know that.
The weight of the vehicle is both rider or driver and car, yeah.
Yeah. The downside of that is, of course, you end up with jockeys.
Yeah, you know? No matter what. Because even if you do say that, okay, the bike has to weigh, 148 kilos for a four cylinder, something like that. Right. So great. We've got this much to juggle with for the rider. It's 148 kilos dry, whatever it is, 300 and some odd pounds, motorcycle only, add the rider on. If you set a different weight that included the rider, well, it's still advantageous to have a lighter, smaller rider, because then you can ballast the bike where you want.
And, exactly.
Yeah, so you can put that weight exactly where you want it by using extraordinarily expensive, very, very dense materials to increase the weight in certain spots. And it's all about balance and center of gravity and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, no. So the thing is, my point is that you'd be penalizing the bigger guys much more than they are penalized right now. Right now, they're penalized. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. See, I'm not 100% sure. I follow your thinking on that one. I know they would still be penalized. That it'd still be advantageous to have a little guy. But I'm not sure if I follow you that they'd be penalized more than they are now.
No, sorry. I'm not saying that the riders would be penalized. I think that the sport would move towards smaller and smaller riders.
Probably.
And it is.
It's somewhat inevitable anyway. One disadvantage that smaller guys have, and Pedrosa faced this, and I think still faces this, is the simple upper body strength and momentum and all of that to wrestle this motorcycle around. Because as any motorcycle rider knows, the bike really wants to go straight. And to force it into a turn, you have to overcome gyroscopic effects. There's all kinds of physics involved, all sorts of things going on. And this can get really tiring over a 26 lap race. And Pedrosa generally does look pretty beat when he gets onto his podium interviews, because he's making the podium.
Right, right.
And he
proved us wrong, race two, 2006, about that.
yes, he did. I mean, and yeah, the theory was that he was too small and he simply couldn't deal with it and all that. No, he's been eating his bananas and he's, he can handle it. But I think it does take a bigger toll out of him than it does out of the guys that have, simply more upper body strength just because they're bigger.
Yep.
Yeah. So, all right, moving on. Let's go. Fifth place.
He also had a great race.
Yes.
But there's not much to talk about there. He had a couple of. He actually, I think, pretty much was in fifth the whole time, wasn't he?
Yeah, he pretty much was. But he also qualified 11th, so he did something right, and yeah. That's good for him. But yeah, he
had a great start. He had a fantastic start. He was in fifth. Then he was in fourth for a little bit. Him and
a little bit of a battle with Vermeulen,
Not much to say there, so we can move on.
Right, and we didn't see a whole lot of it. I mean, MotoGP has been pretty good about showing us the what's going on farther down the grid, but yeah. Jorge Lorenzo came in sixth position. There's been a lot of talk about Jorge and what's been going on with him and what was happening with this race and all of that. He qualified seventh. And he finished sixth. So he basically sort of, he ran his race, in a nutshell. Is he holding back and conserving energy and all of that sort of thing?
Well, there was that, I think he got taught a lesson. It's going to be very hard when your hide is actually the one being whipped. And I don't mean by metaphorically, I mean, he's actually gotten pretty seriously beat up. I was just talking to a friend of mine who's been riding. He used to be a racer, and he is going to have knee replacement surgery. And he was talking about how he can't even will his leg. It's like his leg is refusing to do what he's asking it to do when he's on the motorcycle. And this is his right leg, so it's not super bad, but. Basically, he likes to use the rear brake a lot. He's an old school, racer. So even though he's riding a V-Strom with me, he, by the way, kicks my ass on these back roads that we go on.
Yeah.
And but he's your body actually will say sorry, buddy, but no, I ain't doing this. And I've had this kind of thing where like I had a major injury on my hip, and that was affecting the way that my shifting foot was working. It's just like everything was like I actually had to think about it. Like, okay, foot, move up. You know, I think the body has all sorts of mechanisms built into it that are going to prevent further damage to a damaged area. And Jorge has two damaged ankles. And plus this, you know, it just taught him a lesson, I think. So he's probably taking it a little bit easy. But he also was at a good pace. And I expect he's going to win at least one more race this year.
I agree.
He'll be back.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, Jorge's not done. I tend to think that, I mean, that might be true. I'm not going to, you know, disagree with you on that one. But I almost wonder if he hasn't had a coaching session along the lines of...
Oh, that too. I think you're right.
Yeah, you don't win the race on Friday practice, dude. You know, yeah. Give it a rest. You don't need to crash three times on Friday practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... But yeah, he'll be, you know, he's still somewhat in contention, and I think he will be back. So, all right, moving on, Chris Vermeulen.
He had a good fight with Nakano and with Dovizioso.
Yes,
finished. This is one of his better finishes. Well, he finished fifth in France, but this, other than that, this was his best finish. Oh, and he had seventh in Catalonia, so the. So he's been a set.
Now, how much do you think that Vermeulen has been basically told that he needs to start showing some results, or that's the feeling that he's getting, whether or not he's been actually told this, or it's just the way it is, or whatever. That
I don't know. I mean, you know, there's rumors flying around that he's going back to World Superbike. So obviously, if that was the case, I think that there's going to be some upheaval in Suzuki because Ben Spies is definitely coming in.
Right.
You know, I just don't see it blocked. I think he's going to be their rider for 2009. So someone's going to have to go. They probably would rather keep Caparossi than Vermeulen, even though Caparossi's old man and he's getting hurt. I do think that Caparossi has more in him to help develop the bike.
And more marketability.
And more marketability.
Let's go back to that whole, it's more than just a simple race.
Yep.
Right.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I agree. And I mean, Caparossi's old. He's the oldest guy in the paddock. He is realistically probably due, if not for retirement, he's certainly due to think about retirement. And you and I exchanged a few emails that, boy, you know, we don't want to see Caparossi go out in the same way that like Sete Gibernau went out
right.
A couple of years ago, where it's primarily due to injuries. But on the other hand, you know, we all got to go sometime for some reason or another. So, I don't know. I think, though, that a garage with Caparossi and Ben Spies could be, you know, that would give Spies a year with basically the tutelage of this, you know, MotoGP master. And, you know, would that not be a good thing?
You know, I remember in 2007, maybe halfway through the season, there was a thread on the Ducati list that I'm on about how Stoner was dominating thanks to the tutelage of Caparossi.
I'm not sure about that.
And I think it's complete BS because from what I hear, actually, Caparossi is a very, very competitive. Well, obviously, duh. He's competitive, but he's actually kind of an ass.
Really? Yeah.
So
when you're getting spanked kind of by this 20-year-old kid, I don't think you're going to be given a whole lot of information.
I'm not so sure if he would actually gain from the tutelage directly, but I think that the bike would, and therefore that would transfer on to Spies.
And it would also depend if Ben Spies is on his way to winning a world championship or if he's just down there, you know, in the fifth and sixth range with Caparossi type of a thing.
Yeah.
I think that would enter into it.
It's similar to like Tozen picking Yamaha because he knew that even though he might not actually get Rossi's settings, especially if Rossi's on Bridgestones, he knew that just having Rossi being part of Yamaha would make the Yamaha a better bike because he would just not stand for it. You know, I mean, he's obviously going to be... He was making so much noise about leaving the company last year. I'm sure that lit the fire under a lot of people's asses.
Yeah, that makes a certain amount of sense. And also, though, wasn't Tozelin too kind of happy about working with Colin Edwards as well?
Yeah, you know, of course. I'm just saying that was one of the reasons that he said that. And I think that this Caparossi Spies thing could work out nicely. The old master, you know,
right.
Plus the new,
right? And not to, you know, but you know, and I don't want to start a whole Chris Vermeulen thing, but I'm not sure that would be the same dynamic going on with Vermeulen and Spies.
Yeah, and you know, I like Vermeulen a lot. Mm-hmm.
He's got to get rid of that hat.
He's a neat guy.
I hate that hat.
What's that?
He's got to get rid of that hat. It's just awful.
But it's, you know, he's got this. It's part of his style. Whatever.
I suppose.
At least it's not. At least it's not that stupid thing that Vizioso wears.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway,
we digress. We're talking about fashion.
Shinya Nakano had his best finish of the year.
Yes,
in eighth.
Eighth you know, place for Shinya Nakano.
He's averaging ninth.
He qualified in, ninth. He picked up a spot. Yeah. So good for Shinya. We've talked about Shinya Nakano enough. And I mean, we were talking about it when I was watching the race. It's like, what's up with Shinya Nakano? You know, and it's just, I don't know. There's a lot of theories that you can float out there and... Yeah.
I'm actually going to be surprised if he is in MotoGP next year.
I agree. And I mean, it's kind of sad to see him go because he's a dedicated guy. He's got a lot of talent, but he's just not getting the results and hasn't done for a while. And
pretty much since he left Kawasaki, it's been just downhill.
Pretty much downhill from there, yeah. And I mean, never should have left.
He's definitely doing better than he was doing on the Konica bike, but still.
But that's the place that old racers go to die. So, okay. Ninth spot, James Toseland, the heart wrenching tragedy of Donington, was behind him. Managed to finish ninth, qualifying 13th. So picked up four spots. Had a good race. We saw a little bit of it on the feed.
A couple guys in front of him did crash. He did okay.
Yeah, did okay. Exactly. I think Toseland, you still have to regard this year as a building year for Toseland. You know, all hope is not lost. He's a capable guy. He'll do well. But you do have to give him a little bit of time. He's racing a lot of unfamiliar tracks. He's still, comparatively speaking, learning the bike.
He's raced at Assen many, many times. So
yes, exactly. And at Donington as well. But... Right. Overall, you know what I'm saying is overall that you know we will see James Toseland next year. How's that sound?
Oh yeah,
yeah. So there you go, no brainer.
And he's still having a better year than I expected him to have.
You think so? What's he in the championship?
He dropped. You know, because of the Donington one.
Yeah, the Donington was
a disaster. He was fit for a while.
Yeah, that was really unfortunate. He just had too much pressure going on. So he's eighth in the championship, eighth, 60 points.
Ahead of Shinya Nakano in ninth.
Yeah, it's actually, I'm sorry?
But, you know, Colin had a pretty crappy couple of races in the beginning. Well, except for, like, Qatar, but, so he jumped past Toseland. Dovizioso has been creeping up there.
Right.
And Nicky Hayden recently... You know, his results got better, and of course, getting out no points in Donington meant he dropped quite a few spots in two races.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, he's not doing bad.
Nope.
So, yeah, no. Talking about guys that aren't going to be in MotoGP next year, finishing 10th spot, Silvan Guintoli. What do you think on that one? Are we going to see Silvan next year?
It was a pretty good race for him, actually.
It was a good race. This was a good race, but. But
Silvan Guintoli, I think Silvan Guintoli is going to be around. Yes,
you think so? Okay,
yeah.
This was his highest finish of the year, 10th spot. Yeah. I tend to have my doubts, but silly season is only barely underway. We haven't really started playing musical chairs quite full on yet. So
I wouldn't be surprised if he stayed with that team. Actually,
really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to see how that goes out with Elite J. You know, I mean, he's a nice enough guy. I've actually talked to him in person, and he's you know, super great. I'm sure that, Hoffman will disagree. But he seemed like a great guy. So in any event, we'll see how that one pans out in 2009. Finishing 11th spot, it's that crazy Italian guy that we know and love, Valentino Rossi. Who pretty much just simply overcooked crashed. It. Yeah. You know, he screwed it up. And
I love the fact that there was actually, after the race, the Pugnier said,
hey, look, it's not just me.
Like, you know? He was like, he's really frustrated and like, Here's what he said. He said, I sure am very disappointed because I did good practice, a good start, and I was fifth after the first corner. And then, you know, so basically what happened with Rossi was Rossi went, you know, the racetrack starts with a couple of rights, and then you go to the left where the tire isn't maybe quite as warm, and he put the gas on a little bit too high. And actually he said basically he acted kind of like a dickhead because he was, those are his words, because he was trying to go just fight to the front as quickly as possible.
Right.
Instead of taking his time, and paid the price, took out the Depailler. But I just found that comment from Depailler funny.
Yes.
Because he has had good, he's had great practices before. He's had great qualifyings before, and then he crashed.
Yeah.
By himself.
I agree.
So
yes.
It's kind of funny for him to be, you know, but he must be so relieved to be able to blame
someone else. Yes, RDP has a reputation as a bit of a crasher, and but yeah, Rossi on the other hand does not have the reputation as a crasher, and so for him to take someone else out is very, very unusual, and I don't blame the other guy in that case for sort of pointing it out.
Right.
Especially when you get to point it out against Valentino Rossi, motorcycle racing god. So and Kropotkin had an excellent his Assen write-up was excellent. You know, that the one lesson, you know, you got to remember that you don't win the race in the first corner. However, right. The corollary to that is that you can easily lose the race in the first corner.
Right, right.
And
I've seen that happen many, many times to the racers. You know, Rossi did something stupid in Valencia, too, before, and it cost him a championship. Hopefully this will not take him out of the running. I mean, he's only 4 points behind.
Yeah, no.
The fact that he actually got only 4 points behind Pedrosa is really critical, because all he has to do is win a race.
Yes.
You know, that's right. All.
However, the season is only halfway over. We still have 9 races left. So,
yeah. And there's a lot of tracks where he is going to be not even in contention against Stoner, I think.
You think so? Yeah, actually, yeah. That's true. Yeah, we've got...
There's a lot of good Dakai tracks coming up after the break.
Right, right, right. Notably, Malaysia, first one for sure.
I think Laguna is going to be a very interesting race this year.
I agree. I'm looking forward to Laguna big time. I really hope that we can avoid any silly tangle-ups like we had with Hopkins and Hayden last year.
Oh, yeah.
And just see a real race. But yeah, Laguna is going to be an interesting one, because Stoner seems to have mastered that track, and
it's going to be seems good. To be very good there. Obviously, Hayden's great there.
Right, all the Americans you can count on are going to do fairly well. Stoner seems to have figured it out. Rossi, I think, has mostly figured it out.
Melandri's last chance.
Melandri has, despite his 2005 comments that, you know, it's basically the track sucks. It's going to be an interesting one Although it's not a high speed, full on mega horsepower track, there's a lot of corners where the getting the drive out of the corner is very, very important. And, the elevation changes and all of that we have at Laguna are significant. So it's a little bit like Brno, where you have the horsepower hill kind of thing going on.
Right, right, exactly.
Those are going to be telling, it's very, very significant factors in what's going on at that race. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope you are too. So also, I'm looking forward to hanging out with you in actual live, real life person.
Yeah, and, it's going to be good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's going to be a great time.
I definitely want to mention the fact that when Rossi fell, he had to hold on to the clutch to keep the motor from dying, because push starting would have cost even more time. So he managed somehow to, even though he fell, he managed to hold on to the handlebar and keep the clutch in.
Mm-hmm.
And because it actually fell on that side, that must have been pretty pretty tricky.
Right. Incredible presence of mind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after the race, we found out that he had no shifter. He basically had a little piece of the arm left. There was nothing to put the toe underneath. He shoved his foot in there, kind of reminiscent to the 2006 Jerez race, but that was just the rear brake, which is, you know, much less of an issue. We're talking about his shifter,
right?
And he somehow managed to get times that were pretty much on par with the leading guys.
Rossi's incredible with being able to still function with this broken motorcycle, you know?
Yeah.
And just go out there and yeah, bits are, you know, are gone, and he can still, you know, persevere and manage. And you pointed that out, because I, as we talk about a little bit later in the show, as I talk about a little bit in the show, I had my track day this past Monday, and I had a crash, and I broke some bits on the motorcycle, and Jules was kind enough to send me a text that said, Rossi would have finished. And I was like, yeah, thanks, Jules. So, but it's, you know, he is, and this is the stuff that we see and hear. You see other racers, they
walk away.
They walk away. They're done. The motorcycle, oh, you know, it's broken. And you know, you can't blame them, you know, because it is, you know, the motorcycle is broken. But Rossi gets on there and somehow manages to not only finish the race, but, you know, pick up a few spots as well. What the hell?
And remember, he was actually 30 seconds, 33 or something like that seconds.
I know.
Behind Melange when he actually got going.
Many other riders would have been in very severe danger of being lapped. And and Rossi manages to not only close that gap but pass people.
Right, yeah, exactly. The only time when he was slower than the leaders. I mean, I'm not, Stoner definitely was pulling away. I don't think that there would have been a neck and neck battle with Valentino Rossi and Stoner unless Rossi had gotten the whole shot.
Right.
But he was, his times are very close, and at the end he was actually faster than Stoner. But I think Stoner was kind of probably.
On, you know, sort keeping, of a maintenance mode, the last, so what, like 6 or 7 laps of the race?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But he did set the third fastest lap of the race, Rossi did, and the only times where he was slowed down was when he actually had to pass Melandri, and then he also passed Elias, and he did that. He actually took a long time passing Melandri.
Right.
Melandri did not want to let him go by.
No. And it was classic Rossi. Set him up. Finally makes the pass. Yeah.
But it took him 2 laps.
Yeah. Which is a long time for Rossi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, so, I mean, obviously, you know, again, this is a fanboy show, right? But no matter what you can say, this guy is well worthy of our respect and, I don't know, what do you want to call it? Adoration or whatever it is as a motorcycle racer, just because he's so stunning, you know, so unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay, so 12th spot, Tony Elias. Tony. And qualified.
And then 13th spot.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he picked up what?
I mean, what can you say? I mean, you know, the thing I'd like to say about Melandri. Tony, Elias. I think it's going to be very interesting what happens to Tony Elias. He's had some incredibly amazing moments in MotoGP and also some really low points.
Yeah.
And he's just not. He's having trouble with his bike. So I don't know what's going to happen to him. There's a lot of people that are going to be gunning for spots on teams next year. There's not going to be. I don't think there's going to be any extra bikes on the grid.
No, right? No, I agree. I mean,
both
we're looking
Kawasaki
at,
and Suzuki have said that they will not field another team.
Right.
So I don't think we're going to be seeing any more bikes, and there's going to be new people moving in. So I think Tony Elias is on the cutting block, unfortunately.
And it's a bit of a shame, really, because Elias, I think, is. Well, he and Melandri both had somewhat similar careers prior to their Ducati disasters. And Elias has got a lot of talent. He's you know, he's a good rider. And it's just that for whatever reason, how, you know, they can't seem to wrap their heads around it or just whatever it is going on. You've got two guys that are just top-notch, Melandri and Elias. You know, maybe not absolute top-notch. They're not Rossi. They're not Stoner. They're not Pedrosa. But they're certainly in, you know, in the running with the Haydens and the Edwardses and the
Osos and Vermeulens.
Yeah, those guys.
Yeah, definitely.
That, you know, and it's just, it's sad to see them so far down the grid so consistently.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. The thing about Marco that's really interesting is that Supo has finally, you know, we talked about this last show that Supo, Livio Supo has said that he's basically given an ultimatum to do better in the next 2 races. I'm not sure if that included Assen. I think he wants to see how he does in Laguna, since Marco does well in Laguna. But
yeah.
Here's, talk about silly season. There's been some rumors that should Ducati decide to put Sete in for Marco, which is a rumor that's starting to gain a lot of speed, gaining a lot of validity.
Yeah,
that Marco might be asked by Kawasaki to sit in for Hopkins, who was injured, and that means that we're talking about like now, Saxon Ring and Laguna Seca possibly, which is really
incomprehensible. Wow. Yes.
It's hard to believe that something like that would happen, but maybe we'll see.
When's the last time we saw a change like that? Have we? In mid-season?
In mid-season between two factories? I don't think I've ever seen that.
Yeah, no, I don't recall it. And that's huge.
Two teams.
Did you see the story on MotoGP News? You know, the source of news that you can trust, that Livio Supo has made efforts to get Marco Melandri certified as, mentally incompetent or whatever, so he can
kill his contract. Thank you, Jim Race, for saying that.
Yes. If you haven't seen MotoGP News, it's MotoGPNews.com, and it's a satire website. But Stewie over there takes the news, the real live news, and puts this bizarre and interesting twist on it, and you just find yourself cracking up. And one of those is that, you know, Livio Supo has trying to make sure that Marco Melandri is judged mentally incompetent, and that way he can get out of his contract.
Yeah. Exactly.
And,
I'll say it again. I will not be surprised if we see Sergio Giovinazzi racing in Marco Melandri's spot before the end of the year. I don't know if it's – I just don't see it happening at Saxon Ring. Because
right.
I really do think that they want to see how Melandri will do at Laguna. They're going to need him at Laguna.
Yeah, possibly. Sete has been testing at Mugello past couple of days, and he's doing quite well. Yeah. And this is a guy who hasn't raced for a year and a half. He's he retired due to injuries and all of that, and you've got the whole Sete Gibernau thing going on as well. So. It would be, to say the least, it would be very, very interesting to see him back in MotoGP.
Oh, yeah.
Way.
Yeah.
But would he be up there battling?
What's that?
Would he be up there up front battling with Rossi? You know, this is the days of old? I kind of doubt it.
No. No way.
Yeah.
No way. But it will be interesting. Will he be able to tame the Ducati other than these other three guys? Because if he does, there may be a huge lesson learned there. And the fact that he's been away for a year and a half might actually be a good thing. Because it's not a gradual change. It's going to be like, okay, I got to figure this thing out. I mean, his lap times are actually getting pretty close to what the test riders are getting.
Yeah, and it's... Yeah, and that's kind of interesting. For a guy who, in theory, hasn't been on a motorcycle for a year and a half, I'm not sure what... You know, we haven't heard anything about Sete, of like what he's been doing. Yeah. But, one thing he has not been doing, and that's riding a MotoGP motorcycle. So,
right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So okay. That takes us – we kind of covered Marco Melandri already, finishing 13th. So 13 riders finished. Everybody was in the points. This was one of the smaller grids that we've had because only 16 riders were on the grid because we had
we had some crashers.
Yeah, okay, let's cover the crashers. I was kind of covering the grid at the same time, but yeah, you're right. Let's go ahead and cover the crashers. First DNF was our favorite first DNF pick, RDP. Yeah. And basically Randy Pugnay, and it wasn't his fault this time, so we shouldn't be unfair, but Rossi brought him out.
I do want to say a big thanks to whoever punched in the numbers on Ride On 2, because according to the official finishing results, Alex De Angelis is listed last, even though he crashed after De Pugnay. Because I think basically if they crash in the first lap, I think maybe they just randomly just pick one guy or something. But
well... I don't know. Yeah.
So the thing is, on Ride On 2, we had this rule one time where we was like, we're just going to go by whatever MotoGP.com posts, right?
Uh-huh.
But I think somebody probably said, okay, that's ridiculous. There's no way that De Angelis should be listed last because he crashed like three corners later.
Right. Right. So
anyway, so thank you, yes. Jim. Because I think it was Jim that plugged those numbers in.
I agree, because I also picked RDP as my first out for Essen, so I picked up an extra, 1 point for that?
Two. That's worth 2 points.
Is it 2 points? So, I picked up 4 points on the Ride On 2 tipping, which is, for me, pretty spectacular. I'm in like 73rd or 83rd or something spot, which, I'm gunning for you, Jules. I'm coming up. But whatever. The tipping is not my strong point. Okay, so RDP not finished the first lap. Alex De Angelis also didn't finish the first lap. Separate incident. Crashed out.
And actually, Grassini had some harsh words for him. He said, okay, he's got to stop crashing.
Yeah, well, it's getting expensive.
Yeah.
And Alex De Angelis, a bit of a non sequitur or whatever, you know, because he was one of our promising rookies. I was thinking, you know, wow, we've got the...
He was, but this is not so surprising, don't you think? I mean, he's known to be a, you know, winner or Bennett kind of guy in the 250s, too.
Yeah, that's true. You know,
it was only the last season that he was in 250s last year that he had more consistent results. Before that, he was crashing all the time.
Hmm. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
This is not a big surprise.
Yeah, and hopefully though, the thing is, the guy's got an incredible amount of talent, and you know, let's not forget Casey Stoner had a reputation as a bit of a crasher in 2006. So maybe Alex De Angelis can overcome those same things.
You know, Wesley Clark talking about John McCain being a crasher does not automatically qualify you for world champion.
Yes, exactly. I don't think we're going to see Alex De Angelis beating Casey Stoner in a head-to-head battle anytime soon. Okay, I will agree with you on that one. Been a crasher.
Took a mixing to complete bizarre.
Yes, so and then Ant West also DNF'd.
That was a real shame because, you know, Kawasaki had just one rider on the grid, and he went off in that same corner that everybody had crashes at Assen
right.
this weekend.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, it just, you know, it takes some guys out, takes some bikes out. I think we got to talk about Ben Spies a little bit, too.
So Caparossi didn't start, and Hopkins didn't start because he was hurt.
Right.
In a crash on
in practice, on Friday. Was it practice or qualifying, whenever it was?
Ooh, you know what? I don't remember. I think it was qualifying, actually.
I think it was qualifying.
Maybe, yeah.
Because he was doing quite well. And Caparossi, early on in the practice days, crashed out and got, like, you know, further injuries. And Ben Spies,
well, no, he was hurt from Dunnington, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. He shouldn't have really come back. He wasn't quite ready. And I was a little surprised because initial rumor was that Ben Spies was possibly going to ride Assen, and then it's like, no, Caparossi's coming back, you know, and then he crashes. If I recall correctly, it was on the first practice day. And it was definitely on the first practice day because the ride was offered to Spies.
And he didn't take it.
And he was even encouraged to take it by MotoGP mentor, but terrible commentator, Kevin Schwantz. And you should take this ride. And he's been in a lot of the forums and in some of the news and everything. You know, Spies has been criticized for not doing this. But I'm of the opinion, I think also you are too, Jules, that Spies probably made the right decision on this one.
What people are forgetting is that he's right now, he's testing in Indianapolis. And
yes.
If anything had gone wrong for him at Assen,
that would have been
he would
out.
Have missed that test.
Right,
and this
right.
is very important for him because he's actually a wild card.
And this is for the two American races, both American races, he's scheduled a wild card.
Exactly. And so the thing is, he gets to basically have a day to really play, or 3 days to really play with the bike, that no other racer on the grid does because...
At a track that will be unfamiliar for everybody else.
Exactly.
Right.
Basically, you're not allowed to test unless you're a wildcard rider.
Right.
He's a wildcard rider, so I think he actually did a smart thing.
Right. The only guys that are riding at Indy are the, you know, the official test riders and guys that might show up as a wild card and all that sort of thing. That's why we're not seeing Hayden and Rossi and Stoner and all these guys getting in some laps at Indy because they're not allowed to according to the rules. And so they're doing a 3 day test session over there?
Yeah.
I think it is.
They got one more day tomorrow.
Yeah. I haven't got the story. Got a couple listeners that I know that are going to try to make it out there to watch the testing, and that would be kind of fun because you know the place is going to be pretty much empty.
Yeah.
Bring
the cameras because you're going to be able to get some great photos.
Oh, yeah. Any photographers are going to have a great time. But yeah.
Dealers out there.
Olivier Jacques is back out there.
He's been testing for Kawasaki.
Yeah, he's testing for the Kawasaki. Yeah, but it's kind of cool to see, you know, he's a name actually popping up in the news. And
Aoki
is out there for the Suzuki and got a couple other guys that I don't necessarily recognize their names testing. But all the brands are out there. All the factories are out there getting in some laps at Indy to try to figure out the settings and so forth that they need for Indy. And Spies is so lucky to have this. And this is much more valuable than what he would have got at Assen, because at Assen he would have only had the Saturday to the Friday at Assen to practice, and on a still somewhat unfamiliar bike, unfamiliar track. Then he goes out and races, and then he finishes, 14th or 13th or whatever, right?
Right, right.
And and he's got an AMA championship here to consider as well. He doesn't need to go out there and get needlessly injured. And all of that. So I think that Spies made the right decision. And
I totally agree.
Yeah. You're gonna take a lot of heat for something like that, because are you passed up a MotoGP ride? What are you talking about? I still think that one was, it was probably a difficult decision, because he was actually there. It wasn't like he would have had to last minute fly out from, I don't know, wherever it is, Texas or wherever he lives, and go to to Holland. He was already there, and he turned it down. So he did take some heat for that, but I have to say that I think that he made the right decision, and that's a good thing. So we will see, now that Spies has a couple of days under his belt at Indy on the track, on the bike, that he's going to be racing when MotoGP actually comes to Indy in September. If that's going to be any sort of advantage at all, and I certainly think it will be something.
Oh, it's going to be a huge advantage. I'm not sure if he'll be able to actually make it, pay off in terms of like a podium.
No,
but,
something.
But it's going to be big. It's
right,
big.
Right.
I mean, he's not. It's not just an advantage on the track. It's the confidence that he's going to have racing that motorcycle.
Right. Exactly. Well, Nicky Hayden's been around that track a few times.
Yeah,
on the 1909, whatever it was.
He did actually take a MotoGP bike out there.
He did.
Before the,
I think
was
it was
the Indy 500?
It was still pretty cool though. He didn't push it.
Yeah.
And because I know he rode the he's ridden several laps out there. Hayden has this sort of publicity stuff, and these photos were up on MotoGP.com and all of that of Hayden out there tooling around on a. I can't recall what it was, 1909 Indian or whatever it was, some ancient motorcycle. And then also he did a CBR for a little bit, I think. And then I think he also rode the RC212. But other than that, nobody's touched Indy yet. And it's different. You're not going to have, you can't play PlayStation. This is a brand new. we laugh, but this is true. This is what they do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's like you're a brand new rider. You've never been to this track. Break out the PlayStation. And they don't have that luxury with Indy. And you can't even. It's not like it's the same circuit that Formula One. Even it's a different. So it's going to be a good one.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And you know, there's been a couple of YouTube videos that people have uploaded about during the test.
Oh yeah, I haven't seen them.
The track looks unbelievably flat.
It is unbelievably flat.
I thought they were going. I thought there was some talk about them putting in a couple of fake hills and stuff like that in there.
I'm really bummed.
I don't like flat tracks.
Yeah,
I like elevation changes.
I don't recall seeing much about a whole lot of elevation changes, but I'm sure even if it was, you're not talking about a lot.
The only elevation change you get is the banked turn.
Yeah,
and which really Olivier Jacques had a lot to say about that. First of all, you're running like a meter away from the wall. He said it's kind of freaky.
I'll bet.
And he said it was really fun actually.
Yeah.
To ride up on the banking.
Yeah.
But man, the tire guys are going to be wringing their brains.
I can tell you a little bit about riding next to a wall, because I did my track day at Portland. And the back straight, so-called back straight at Portland, is actually a very, very long right-hander. I mean, it's just a curve, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the correct racing line is right up next to a wall. And that's an inside wall. If all of a sudden something weird happens and everything, you're naturally going to be pushed away from that wall. So that's nothing like riding next to an outside wall. But I'll tell you, it freaks you out. It freaks me out. That's for damn sure.
I was freaked out when I was watching the guys Nürburgring on the last corner before the straight, how close their heads were coming to the inside wall. And I'm not even on the bike. I'm just watching, a feed.
It is amazing. Did you see the shots from the Macau Grand Prix? I can't remember the rider. He's an American, and he's one of these, real road racing guys. And he's taken this corner where there's an inside wall, and his shoulder is touching the wall. He's leaving marks. God. Yeah. It's like, I just can't imagine. I honestly can't. And I mean, like I said, you know, having done, and I'm not saying that my track day at Portland is, you know, anything like MotoGP, but you know, you're riding fast on this track and all of that, and you've got this wall right next to you. Believe me, it's a huge mental thing.
Well, I mean, you should see what it's like in Finland when you're heading at a wall at turn 10.
Yeah, that's a good time to take.
And then you have to like bank it in, and they did manage to slow it down with the chicane that they added for the motorcycles, but it's still, that wall is pretty scary. Actually, all of Infineon used to be that way, but that was before I started doing track days there, and then they dug up a lot of the walls and made a lot more runoff area.
The carousel looks like fun at Infineon, but
I think I'm still missing a couple parts that are lying around in the carousel.
I'm going to talk about my track day here a little bit after this call, kind of a solo effort. But in general, on track days, I'm really looking forward to our time at Thunderhill when you and I are going to go down and we're going to do a couple days at Thunderhill, which is a great track for lots of elevation.
And we're going to ride in the same group this time.
Yeah.
Which means we're going to have to do a little bit of racing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Put some money on it.
Yeah, right. Jill's trying to take my money, folks.
I don't know.
I think you should come up to Portland one of these days too, dude. I mean, if you can possibly, you know, swing, because I know it's a long drive and all of that, but it's...
I'm out of figuring out how to get my bike up there. I would totally do it.
Just ride up to my house, stay overnight. We'll drive up together. You know, I mean, the thing is, you got to take several days doing it. And if the unspeakable happens and you crash, I'll get you back down to San Francisco somehow. So, cool.
Okay, we'll do something like that.
Yeah, one of these days. So in any case, I think we covered all of Assen.
We really took our time.
That's all right. You know, yeah, we're about almost an hour and a half-ish marker here, but that's cool. I think it was a good conversation. I enjoyed it a lot, so it's always a pleasure having
you. Can we just say something really quick?
Sure, yeah.
Let's not forget this horrible piece of news about Eurosport losing the coverage for MotoGP next year.
Yes, rest in peace, Eurosport.
They're my favorite announcers of any sport ever. Maybe with a possibly some Spanish language announcer that's screaming goal during some soccer match. But anyway, these guys, Julian Ryder, Toby Moody, and Randy Mamola, to me are like by far the most amazing commentary team. And they're going to lose a contract next year.
Right.
Eurosport's no longer going to have exclusive rights to cover the races for the European market. They're going to be given to localized stations. So BBC is going to be covering it, and like local Spanish and national Italian, Spanish, German. French. I don't know what they're going to do in like, you know, Estonia or something. They're probably just going to get the English feeds.
Right. But will they even get those feeds? Do they get BBC
maybe
in Estonia?
Or maybe not. Maybe they're going to have to watch it all on MotoGP.com like us poor folks here.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, we do get speed. But here's the interesting thing. So there's a rumor going around that the guy that's going to get that Julian Ryder is going to get the commentary position at MotoGP, at Dorna.
Oh, really?
Which would be...
What, taking place of Nick Harris?
Cool. Can you imagine? So the thing is, when I first David Emmett mentioned that he heard this rumor,
mm-hmm.
Kropotkin, and an email to me. You know, it's just a stupid rumor. It's, you know, silly season.
Sure, silly
season
for commentators, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is that I looked up a conversation that we had on Right On 2 a couple of years ago where we had that Fire Nick Harris thread.
No offense
to Nick Harris. He's been around. He's kind of the voice of MotoGP in a lot of ways. He's in our intro. I remember seeing something about him having the contract, because Nick Harris Enterprises having the contract with Dorna, and I wasn't sure whether it was 2000 through 2009 or until 2009, and it's actually until 2009, so that's interesting, because that would give that rumor a little bit more
A little bit more legs, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure, though. I think Julian Ryder makes a better color commentary guy. You need a play-by-play guy, and then Julian Ryder steps in with his insight and input.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, maybe he, you know, maybe he gets to – I mean, Nick Harris, I think, probably has a big say.
Oh, I'm sure he does. Yeah.
Who he works with, right? So
– well, actually, I wouldn't mind hearing Gavin Emmett, who is the current kind of color guy for Nick Harris, have him be play-by-play with Julian Ryder as a sidekick.
Let's be realistic. Emmett is the play-by-play guy and the color guy.
I know. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying, is make it a name. I mean, obviously, the perfect world would be that, you know, Toby Moody, Julian Ryder, and Randy Mamola just simply shift from Eurosport to Dorna.
Right.
But, you know, if that doesn't happen, if you have the same juggling around of guys. And, I mean, actually, I've come to sort of, in some ways, know and love Nick Harris over the years from an initial, my God, to sort of, you know, actually, he does a pretty good job, sort of an attitude, right?
Well, he's a very knowledgeable guy.
When you're watching
like 125s and 250s, he knows every freaking racer's name and history and everything.
Yes.
He's amazing. It's just that he's not as incisive during the race. He's kind of like an encyclopedia that is, a couple laps behind.
Right. Exactly. And he tends to – and I mean, believe me, this is – actually, here's something I wanted to bring up. The 125 race from Donington was finally on speed, a week and a half later? It was on. And I haven't finished watching the race, so I don't want to get into results. But just talking about the beginning pre-race segment, right? The current MotoGP.com/Dorna, whatever, you know, Nick Harris, Gavin Emmett, the pit guy is named George Titmarsh, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to make fun of anybody's last name. Titmarsh is, I've heard the name before. It's not as extraordinarily common, but it's not an extremely unknown name. Titmarsh, okay?
Where are you going with this?
Oh, I'm going somewhere with it. Nick Harris says, let's go down to pit lane with George Titmarsh. And it's like I cracked up because, he tends to misspeak a little bit. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm not going to criticize the guy because here I am, you know, doing a podcast and trust me, you know, there's misspeaking all the time, but I still did find it fairly amusing. And
that's funny.
I don't know with Nick Harris. I mean, it would be a shame to see him go, but you know, I was pretty upset when Howard Cosell stopped doing boxing and all of that. You know, eventually these guys have to move on.
Right.
And I'd love to see Julian Ryder. And the thing is, we have not seen the last of Julian Ryder. If you go to like Amazon.com or .co.uk or wherever Amazon is in your neck of the woods and look up the number of books that Julian Ryder has written about MotoGP and motorcycle racing in general.
And if you've read them, especially.
I mean,
this guy is unbelievable.
Yeah. This guy is not going away. No. So we will see him somewhere, somehow, some way. It's just, you know, will the team be around of Toby Moody, Julian Ryder, and Randy Mamola? I don't know. You know, it's sad.
That's the thing that I'm upset about because they are such a
Good
tight team. They play off each other so well.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree. And I tend to talk all along about the Formula One team here in the United States of speed with Varsha and David Hobbs and Steve Matchett and to a certain extent Peter Windsor. And it's the same thing. You know, this team makes this sport, you know, that watching this sport, it makes it better. And that if you are only a somewhat casual fan, like I am of Formula One, that simply having this commentary team means that you will watch it. And I'm sure there are people out there that from MotoGP, it's the same situation. Even though hardcore MotoGP fans like you and I, Jules, will be like, you know, what are you, crazy? You know, I'd watch it no matter what.
But that's what the sound of.
Exactly. But there are, there are lots of people out there that enjoy that enjoy that interplay of Toby Moody and Julian Ryder and Randy Mamola. And without it, they may not be so inclined to watch.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, and it is a shame. And I really do hope that, like Heidi Kender, poster and regular on Ride On 2, who lives in Estonia, is going to be able to get some sort of, you know, where is he going to watch MotoGP now? You know, is he only stuck with the online version, which for all of its benefits still has plenty of faults. Yeah. And you know, it's not perfect. And there was some discussion about Dorna's ulterior motives, if you will, of doing this. And I don't know,
possibly being like outclassed by Eurosport.
Well, yeah, and trying to drive listeners to paying for MotoGP, because that way you get the full, you know, what is it now, 50, 60 odd euros for the MotoGP subscription. And you know, you get it all instead of just some sort of Eurosport contract or what have you. And, you know, I don't really know if that, you know, I don't know what the thing is. Dorna's official thing is that they're trying to get everything over the air as much as possible. You know, so BBC broadcasts it over the air. You know, in France, they have whatever station that broadcasts it over the air. Germany, same thing. Spain, the same thing. And the eliminating Eurosport means that, you know, now more people are going to get it over the air free TV. But I don't know. That may be smoke and mirrors.
It also means much more commercials and all that kind of stuff.
So, oh, yeah.
Oh, no, maybe,
well, no commercials on BBC. But
I think there's going to be a lot of people who are going to start feeling the same kind of pain that we feel here in the States with speed.
Yeah. Yeah. Welcome to our world, folks.
Yep.
Yeah. But, yeah, exactly. And it is sad. So I feel your pain, Jules. And with that, we probably should call it a call, because we've kind of gone on, and
and there was a race in World Superbike. There were two races in a World Superbike too that we should have talked about, but there's just no time left.
We could talk about them next week, because we have a like almost a 2 week break now until Sachsenring, yep, which takes place on the weekend of July 12th and 13th. So we can talk a little bit about World Superbike and Misano with the always entertaining Jonathan Green commentating. And kind of cover that a little bit.
Cool.
Right on, dude.
All right.
Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure, as always, to have you on the phone. And we'll talk to you in real soon.
And we like Stoner.
Yes, we do. We love Stoner. He's the best. Bye.
Right. Ciao.
Well, thanks very much for your time on the phone there, Jules. Always nice talking to you. I know that call ran a little long, but it was super interesting stuff. Jules and I had fun doing it, and I hope you guys had fun listening to it as well. So that's going to do it for the MotoGP sort of portion of our show today. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about a track day that I just did with Fergus Caldicott, who has been on the show before, buddy there up in Portland. Unfortunately, Darren Carpenter, our tame Omer racer, was not able to be at this track day, but did a track day on Monday, June 30th it was, up there in Portland with the NESBA group, the Northeast Sport Bikers Association. And it's a different association running the track day. I hadn't been to a NESBA day before. They did a pretty good job. It was it's a little bit different atmosphere than the PSSR dates that I'm accustomed to going to, but still, all in all, I think quite good. I had a great time. It was a roasting hot day. I'm not 100% sure where the temperature got to, but it was at least in the high 80s, possibly 90 degrees. And, of course, this is Fahrenheit, so you'll have to do that conversion to Celsius yourself, because I don't have a little conversion thing up. But it's darn hot. I think it's around 25, if I do recall correctly. But in any case, we had a great day. Fergus got bumped up a group from their intermediates to their experts. He really should have been riding an expert from the get-go, but because it was his first day with NESBA as well, they didn't want him to just jump into expert, so they put him in intermediate. And pretty much after the first session, he had the guy come by on a scooter and give him a little talking to and said, "You either need to slow down or move up a group." So Fergus moved up to the advanced group because he's a wild man on ZX10. And I stayed in the intermediate group in my SV650. We had a great time. And the main reason why I'm kind of jumping in and talking about this track day before I do a full-on call later in the year here with Darren about track days and stuff is that I have to confess, and I want to talk about it a little bit, that I crashed. My last session of the day, and this is the track day was ending. The track was closing down at 4:30. They normally do a 20-minute session each hour for the three different groups. So the intermediates went out at 3:20, and we were scheduled to go from 3:20 to 3:40, and then we could have had another 10 minutes from 4:10 to 4:20, which actually I was planning on just saying, forget it, I'll pack up and kind of beat the rush out of here. So I went out there at 3:20, and I probably did, I don't know, three or four laps. It was hot. I was tired. I basically pushed it a little too hard and overcooked it into turn one and pretty much screwed the pooch on the whole turn. I was going too fast. I tipped it in too late. Next thing you know, I am running wide. I knew I was running wide. I could see that I was running wide. I did do, in my own defense, the right thing and push it over a little farther, you know, overcoming some of that sort of fear and trepidation that you have. And it's like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to make this turn. Push it in a little harder. I did that and still not going to make it. No, this is not good. So I saw a strip of concrete running along the outside edge of the track there, the recently repaved Portland International Raceway track surface, which is wonderful grip, beautiful, smooth. It's a good surface. They put down a good surface on this. But there was a strip of concrete, or so I thought, because as soon as I hit that strip of concrete, I discovered that it was sand, rather deep sand. And I hit this in third gear. I only guesstimating my speed. I was probably running, because I don't have instruments on my SV650, so I have no idea exactly how fast I was going. No speedometer, no tach even, which I'm going to rectify that situation. But whatever, I was out there. Third gear, middle of the power band sort of thing. I don't know, 40 miles an hour, whatever it was. And kind of hit that sand. It stood me right up. Next thing you know, I'm out on the grass, and I'm cooking along the grass, pretty good clip. And I probably did what you're not supposed to do and tried to brake. I wasn't 100% sure. You know, it's just I do recall being on the grass, riding more or less straight up, thinking, oh, no, this is not good. What am I going to do? And at that point, I probably touched the front brake. And as soon as I did that, it was all over. Basically, I went down. I was tumbling, kind of doing the rolling across the grass sort of a thing. Grass sky sort of going on. I do recall remembering, oh no, this is how people break bones. Very, very fortunately, I broke no bones. Came to a gradual stop eventually, sort of did a kind of a pat down assessment of, wow, nothing is too painfully hurt. And I stood up and yeah, I'm all right. Went over and looked at the bike, which had basically slid along on its right hand side, leaving a big furrow in the grass. So I carved a pretty good furrow going along in the runoff area there at turn one at Portland. Ended up broke a rear set bracket, the brake pedal shaft as well, all part of that rear set assembly, and torqued the clip-on handlebar around so far that it broke a small plastic elbow connector on the brake fluid master cylinder. So that would have been a day ender right there, because I didn't have the spare parts that I would have needed for something like that. Ended up, picked the motorcycle up. Not 100% sure what to do. This is the first time I've ever crashed on a track day. So I started trying to push the motorcycle to the tire wall just to sort of get it out of the runoff area, hoping to not spoil everybody else's session and all that sort of thing. And let me tell you, this is a distance that doesn't look like it's all that far when you're riding around, you know, at relatively high speed and stuff. But when you're pushing a motorcycle right after you just crashed and you're hot and sweaty wearing leathers, it's a long way. And so I was pushing the motorcycle. I couldn't see any marshals or anything. I'm like, wow, am I completely alone out here? This is kind of Twilight Zone. And next thing you know, the crash truck showed up because I had noticed they must have red flagged. They did red flag this session. So there was no more motorcycles zooming by. Crash truck came out. We loaded my bike in the crash truck. I went back to the pits. The guys managed to finish their session. They only lost a few laps. So I'm glad that I didn't completely screw up the session. And at the end of the 20-minute session, which, you know, it was probably about 10 minutes or so of sitting in this truck. We got back to the pits, somewhat assessed a little of damage, a bit more. Like I said, a couple pieces broken on the right side rear set, which I've already ordered those from Woodcraft. Excellent company. If you're into building a track bike or anything, you might want to take a look at Woodcraft CFM as far as their rear sets and all the other bits and pieces that they've got going on. They have it all organized by your motorcycle, and it's really cool stuff. And one of the nice things about Woodcraft is I didn't have to buy the whole rear set, because, you know, a whole rear set running around $200 or so, I could just buy the broken pieces. So got those on order, managed to find that the nomenclature of this little elbow connector critter that I have going on my master cylinder, which Anthony Dean at the MCRA, who also owns an SV650, was kind enough to help me out with. Got that. It's very, very inexpensive part, little cheap piece of plastic, which is going to future reference. I'm going to try to fix that. We don't want something so weak on there, on such a logically weak spot. Yeah, whatever. Parts are on order. Be putting that track bike back together, and it was kind of a lesson learned. So that was my first track crash. And I just wanted to pass that on to you guys as, like I said, a little bit of a lesson learned, a little bit of a confessional, a little bit of a, I don't know, a story. Of course, Jules, you know, had a few jokes at my expense, and Darren and Fergus were, you know, everybody was sympathetic, but of course there's also the hard time thing going on, which you kind of deserve, so... It could have been a whole lot worse. As it was, like I said, it was more of a learning experience going down. And for all that, there's a little bit of lasting damage to the motorcycle, unfortunately, like I said, because not only did I break those rear sets in the front master cylinder, little connector critter, but I put another hole in the race bodywork, which the bodywork on my motorcycle is nothing to look at to begin with. So now it's even uglier. And I'm not going to be replacing that because it's still functional. You know, hey, what the hell? Like I said, it doesn't look all that great anyway, so I don't really need to spend $600 on new bodywork. The leathers came out fine. There were no scuffs, no nothing. Just scraped the dirt and little grassy bits out of the Velcro and all of that kind of thing, and they look brand new. So Komodo leathers came through. Showy helmet came through. All of that stuff. Like I said, I was very, very fortunate that I didn't, you know, torque my arm underneath myself or something as I was tumbling across the grass and, break something, because that would have been bad, bad news. And I was also happy to find out that the motorcycle was not as badly damaged as it might have been in another event. So there we go. There's my little mea culpa. And I think that's going to about do it for the show. Thanks very much sticking in there for a long show today. Well, almost 2 hours that we've got going on. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very, very much for downloading it. Don't forget, we have the Socks and Ring coming up. We have a week-long break, so the July 4th weekend here, we have nothing, but on the July 12th and 13th weekend, we got the Socks and Ring, which will be on CBS television. So if you're in the United States, make sure that you change your recorders or your viewing habits or whatever it is to make sure you take into account CBS rather than Speed, and double check your local listings and all that sort of thing. I'll try to mention it in next week's show, but you never know, that might be too late for you. So check that out. And until then, this one is very, very apropos this weekend. Keep the shiny side up and the rubber side down, and try not to hit the grass. And we'll talk to you next week. If you listened this far, you know that it's time for the disclaimer. And sometimes you might get tired of hearing these disclaimers. I sort of occasionally get sick of recording them or making up new, slightly entertaining versions, because I've kind of already gone through all the obvious ones, and now I'm just sort of trying to rummage around and find something, somehow, some way to say in a different way that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All the other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.